FIS Insider, a premium edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Today's host is Senior Editor Chris Sheridan.
Joining us on the show today is Jim Rickards. He's the author of a new book called The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. Jim, thank you for joining us on the show again.
It's great to be with you.
Jim, you start off in your book discussing not the economic impacts of COVID, but the virus itself and a few possible scenarios based on what we've seen historically. Can you share some of what you discuss as it relates to the New Great Depression?
Sure, I'd be glad to do that. And it kind of reminds me when the book first started, this came up last April. Of course, that was the first wave and the first lockdown. We're unfortunately back in another even worse wave and worse lockdown today. But when my publisher called me about this, we had a very nice discussion. And they said, Jim, we love you on economics and the markets, and we need a book on what's going on and all that. But you're not an immunologist, you're not an epidemiologist. So kind of, steer away from the virus and let's talk about the economy. And I said, no. I said, it's like asking me to write about property damage in New Orleans in 2005 and not mention Hurricane Katrina. You can't do that. You have to deal with both topics. So they agree with that and thought that made sense. And I'm not a doctor, and I don't pretend to be one. But, natural science is not impenetrable. I told them, I said, look, I got a degree from Johns Hopkins. I'm not intimidated by natural science. I read over 100 peer-reviewed articles. So without pretending to be more than I am, I did familiarize myself with the three branches, virology, immunology, epidemiology, and kind of knew what you need to know to understand how the virus works. And then, of course, from there, the impact on the economy. And I say right at the beginning of the book, the virus did not cause the depression. The virus caused a pandemic. It was our policy response to the pandemic that caused the depression. In other words, viruses don't, cause unemployment to go up, but they cause conditions. But how politicians, how individuals respond to that is the key. And I'm not sure, we had a set of leaders. I'm not sure a different set would have done much better, or much worse for that matter. There was too much that was unknown. But there were some decisions made that were catastrophic. And you just have to be candid about that. One of them was the lockdown. And I point out in the book that lockdowns don't work. If you have a small island and the only way on and off is a boat and you close the docks and don't let anybody in, don't let anybody out, okay, that works. That is not a description of the United States of America. You can't lock down a whole country. You can't lock down a whole state. People are going to move. People are adaptable. They'll find ways around it. The virus is going to spread. The virus is going to go where it wants. And I point to the fact that President Trump and the First Lady got the virus in early October. They got COVID in early October. I've been to the White House a number of times on official business. It's hard to think of a place that's more locked down. And yet the virus got in there, which again, is just an example of the fact that the lockdowns don't work. Lockdowns don't stop the spread of the virus, but they do destroy the economy. They're very good at that. And that's exactly what we've seen. And one of the points I make, and I think it's an important one, is that, look, if you could work from home, if you could keep out of the way, if you were in, whether it's an ivory tower or you had a vacation home or a place to retreat to, that's fine. But a lot of people couldn't do that. And yet a lot of those businesses were shut down. So who prospered? Again, the subtitle of the book is Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. Well, who won? Well, we know. It's, it was Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and a couple other companies. But the losers were restaurants, bars, gas stations, boutiques, nail salons, 100 different categories of small business. And people sort of took a very condescending attitude towards that. They said, well, we got to lock these businesses down to stop the spread, which was foolish because it doesn't stop the spread. But somehow, if you were an academic or a lawyer or a doctor or a professional or some category, many categories where you could work from home, it was all good. But if you were a bartender, or waitress, or waiter, or manicurist, or sales clerk in a boutique or whatever, too bad for you. And then the stock market did come up after March. But the point I make is that small and medium-sized businesses are 50% of all jobs and 45% of GDP. So you can look down your nose at a particular bar and say, well, too bad, we got to lock you down. But in the aggregate, and that's how you think about it from a macroeconomic point of view, we shut down half the economy. And it's no surprise that we had the worst decline and grow 31% on an annualized basis in the second quarter of 2020. Now, it came back in the third quarter, but didn't come back nearly as much as it went down. We're not out of this, not even close. And I would say we're heading into another recession right now, probably in a recession right now. This will be the first back-to-back recession since 1980, 1981. The reason is very clear, which is you had another surge in the virus and another set of lockdowns. They don't work to stop the pandemic, but they do destroy the economy, and that's what we've done.
So you talk about these three different scenarios, and there's waves that we've seen historically lasting 4 to 6 months, I believe, based on your research. And as you said, you know, you read over 100 different scientific articles and research papers on this. So, you know, you bring a lot of really good research to bear in your book. It's very interesting to read. What are some of these best and worst case scenarios that we could see going forward?
Sure. Well, the best case scenario is that the vaccines work and they're out there now and people are getting getting jabbed, as they say, or injected or immunized. Although the evidence on that is really interesting, a little disturbing, because the Operation Warp Speed, which was directed out of the White House, was successful. There's never been a vaccine like this that was produced in such a short period of time. In fact, this is the first vaccine that's ever been shown to be effective at all against a coronavirus. Now, remember, pandemics have dynamics that actually can be captured mathematically with exponential growth and surges and so forth. But getting down to the virus level, this is not pneumonia. This is not influenza. This is a coronavirus. There have been six coronaviruses that jumped from the animal world to humans. How they got there is a separate issue. I have a whole chapter on that in terms of this coming out of a laboratory in China. But that aside, it's the sixth one. The other five, there were no vaccines. For that matter, we still don't have a vaccine for HIV/AIDS. That's not a coronavirus, but it's another example of where we have treatments. We have things we can do, and people, you know, can survive it and live somewhat normal lives. But that's not the same as a cure vaccine. But we do have a vaccine here, and it's the first one in the case of a coronavirus. The problem is, well, there are two problems. One, the distribution seems to be off to a very bad start. I mean, most of the world's not getting it. The countries that developed it, including the United States, China, UK, Russia, a few others, depending on the vaccine, are getting it. It's rolling out very slowly. New York's a disaster as usual. Some of the doses, you know, they went to extraordinary lengths to get hundreds of millions of doses, but they don't last forever. They have to be frozen. They have to be not just refrigerated, but frozen, as I say. And they have a kind of expiration date. A lot of the doses are expiring. They lose their effectiveness because in New York, in particular, they have not been able to distribute them very efficiently. But anyway, the vaccine is out there now. The best case would be we get better at vaccinating, and the virus does not mutate in a way that makes it resistant to the vaccine. So if those two things are true, you might see this pandemic start to fade late this year, not sooner. I mean, we're in this for another year at best, and perhaps 2 years, but it might start to fade by late this year through some combination of herd immunity and the vaccine actually getting out there. The worst case is that that we continue to kind of bungle our way through the distribution of vaccines, which is the case today. The virus spreads faster than the vaccine can get out there. So sure, you're jabbing or injecting millions of people. That's a good thing. But if the virus is infecting 2 million while you're immunizing 1 million, well, you're losing the race. And that is what's going on now. But worse than that is that the virus mutates in a way that makes it resistant to the vaccine. And there's a name for this. It's called mutation escape or immune escape. And what it means is the virus, as I say in the book, because everyone wants to politicize everything, and it's important to steer away from that. The virus is not a Republican or a Democrat. The virus doesn't care who you voted for. The virus just wants to kill you. And that's all you need to know. The virus just wants to kill you. So, and it's not even clear viruses are alive. No one, we have the, the genetic composition, and you can see it under an electron microscope, but is it alive or not? Scientists don't agree on that. But viruses are very good at surviving or replicating is maybe a better word. They take over a healthy cell and make more viruses, and then they burst the cell walls and it spreads and goes from person to person. Well, when you have a vaccine and or you have antibodies because you've had COVID and you recovered and you have antibodies, so you're immune that way or through the vaccine. So if the virus hops to somebody, you know, somebody has it, they shed, it hops to somebody else, and that person has immunity through the vaccine or because they're a survivor, and then it goes to someone else. So the virus is kind of feeling trapped. The virus is like, hey, I gotta find a healthy body where I can replicate and keep going. And if you can't do that at all, then eventually the virus does die out. But what the virus does, it mutates. It says, okay, I'm going to change it up a little bit. And they do that. That's common. But the question is, of all the chemical bonds, the links on the genome, is the mutation harmless in the sense that it's a part of the genome that doesn't really affect contagion or fate or lethality, or doesn't really end run the vaccine, in which case it doesn't matter very much? Or is it the kind of mutation that does, that escapes, as they say, from the immunity and escapes from the antibodies and the vaccine? Well, if that happens and it starts to spread, then your vaccine doesn't do any good. It does for the first version, but the virus will very quickly, the first version will die out. The second version, the new strain or variant, as they call it, will spread very rapidly. And then you're kind of back where you started. You need a new vaccine. And that's the case with influenza. Influenza is not as fatal as coronavirus, but that's why influenza doesn't go away, because it keeps mutating around whatever vaccine we have. So if that happens and you're back to square one in the vaccine department, where you got to come up with a new vaccine and query how quickly you can do that or whether you can even do it, and the virus is spreading and the lockdown continues, that's your worst case scenario, because now you're into, you know, year three of a pandemic and your economy is flat on its back.
Yeah, you have a quote here. You say, unfortunately, the fact that three of the four great influenza pandemics since 1918 have followed the scenario two second wave pattern, so a first wave and then a secondary larger wave, and similarities between COVID-19 and these influenza pandemics is, in general, leaves open the specter of a larger, more lethal wave to come. So that's one of the scenarios that you discussed that we need to keep in mind. And obviously, right now, we have seen this mutation, the latest mutation, preliminary evidence, still speculative, but shows that it could be anywhere from 50 to 70% more contagious. You know, the data is still out on that, but B117 is what it's being referred to. And obviously, right, we're seeing it spread in South Africa and also in the UK and certain places of the US. Still remains to be seen whether or not it is more contagious, but you know, that could be an example of a mutation that brings about a second wave that we need to be mindful of.
Right. I think the evidence is good that it is more contagious. You're right. We got to take these things one step at a time and gather evidence. But the early indication is that it's a lot more contagious. Now, what's misleading in the reporting is people say, well, it's more contagious, but the fatality rate is not higher. That's misleading in the following sense. If you calculate the rate as fatalities divided by cases, which, you know, is probably the right way to think about it, that rate may not be higher, but the absolute number of fatalities is higher, because if you have more contagion, you're going to have more fatalities, even if the rate is the same. So it's good, you know, tentatively, if this bears out, it's good that the rate's not higher. Okay, but I'm sorry, if your caseload is going up, your fatalities are going up in the absolute sense. And that is showing up in the data. We're seeing that. This is where we are right now is worse than where we were last March. It's kind of hard for people to believe, but caseloads are higher, fatalities are higher. The new strain is out there. Not clear that the new strain will succumb to the vaccine. Hopefully it does, but that's not clear. So a lot of uncertainty at best, and maybe it's worse than that.
Jim, you and I are speaking on January 7th. The S&P 500 is just broke above 3,800 for the first time, new all-time high. Protesters stormed the Capitol building just yesterday. It was major news, and there was some shootings and fatalities, a very sad spectacle that we witnessed. However, that being said, stock market at record highs. It appears that jobs are slowly coming back. Why do you believe that we're in a new Great Depression?
Well, a couple of things. I saw the headlines this morning, like everybody else, you know, mob storms capital, stocks hit new all-time high. And I thought, wow, there's no better expression of the fact that the stock market is disconnected from the real world. Yeah. But the stock market is what it is. The stock market's track record of predicting things is horrible. The stock market did not see the dot-com crash coming, did not see the 2008 financial crisis coming, did not see the 2020 pandemic and financial collapse coming. So the stock market, contrary, I mean, the popular view, or the view they teach you in college, which I urge all students to disregard, is you know, the efficient market hypothesis came out, you know, Eugene Fama, University of Chicago in 1960s. It's mainstream thinking today, which is that, you know, stock markets look into the future, they see what's coming, they discount back to present value, and they fundamentally adjust prices in a smooth and continuous way to reflect the future. Everything I just said is wrong. I mean, what I said is an accurate description of what they teach you and what people think. It's actually completely false. Markets try to look into the future. They do a really lousy job of it. They usually do not see crises coming. The discounting mechanism is not close to kind of where values are going. And you're much better off with getting better predictive analytic models and doing your own work and kind of protecting your wealth or growing your wealth. But don't listen to Wall Street. Now, having said that, you know, if an 18-wheeler is going 70 miles an hour in the wrong direction, it's probably not a good idea to step into the highway and wave and say, hey, you're going the wrong way, because you're going to get killed. You're going to get flattened. So I'm not going to, you know, suggest that people go out and short the stock market just because it's overvalued. It is overvalued. It is going in the wrong direction. But it is what it is. I mean, you've got momentum. You've got passive investing. You've got ETFs. You've got people just throw their money into, you know, Fidelity, Vanguard index funds or whatever, and enjoy the ride. So you don't want to stand in the way of that. But if you ask me if that's the economic reality, if that's sustainable, the answer is no. If you ask me if it's going to turn around, the answer is yes. But, you know, the timing is very hard to get. But let's just kind of flip back to the real economy for a second. Now, you mentioned the S&P 500. But you and I think your listeners and I know that it's the S&P 7. The S&P 500 is a cap-weighted index, which means your market capitalization determines your influence on the index. And there are seven stocks, and we all know what they are. You know, it's Apple, Amazon, Facebook, Google, Netflix, Microsoft, and Tesla. Those seven stocks make up about 40% of the market capitalization of the S&P 500. The other 493, good luck. If you actually separate them out, you can do it if you have the right tools. If you separate out the other 493, they're flat to down on average. Now, yeah, some of them are up, some of them are down a lot. You know, there's idiosyncratic behavior within that group. But the S&P 493 are doing nothing, but the S&P 7, as I call it, are taking the index higher, and everyone's, as I say, enjoying the ride. Well, those seven stocks, by and large, are the most insulated from the effects of the pandemic. They're either digital, or they're technology, or they're in telecommunications. They're not bricks and mortar. They're not retail. They're not the restaurants and bars and nail salons that we talked about earlier. They actually benefit from the pandemic. It just is. I'm not condemning anybody or criticizing anybody. I'm just saying it is what it is. I recently got a new apartment, so I went out and bought a TV for the new apartment a few months ago. And I'm in Best Buy, and I said to this, you know, I chat up the salespeople, try to figure out what's going on. I said, how's business? And he goes, never better, because you know, everyone's locked down; they can't go out. Yeah. So everyone's buying TVs and radios and stuff. I said, got it. You know, that makes sense. So there are winners, and that's the subtitle of my book: Winners and Losers in the Post-Pandemic World. But unfortunately, the losers, well, I mean, some of them are big companies, big industries, you know, airlines, they dropped 80% in the early stages. They've recovered a little bit, but they're still not back to 50% of where they were before the pandemic. So there are certain, cruise ships, resorts, hotels, casinos, airlines, none of those industries are anywhere close to where they were. But they're some of the big ones, you know, movie theaters. Bankruptcies are starting to pile up. Retailers, you know, we know the list. of the companies that have gone bankrupt since last March. And they're lined up at the bankruptcy court, so there's going to be more coming. That is all very clear. So what we have is, and I talk about this in chapter 6 of my book, The New Great Depression, there's a huge gap between perception and reality. The perception is what you correctly described. You know, the S&P is at a new all-time high, and you know, the Dow Jones is close, and so is the NASDAQ. They fluctuate daily, but they're all close to all-time highs. 401ks have been restored. Well, yeah, that's no surprise. If you're heavily invested in an S&P 500 index fund and the index at an all-time high, then your 401k looks great. But that blinds you to what's going on in the real economy, which is, as I say, we're in a recession now. There was a recovery in the recession in the first and second quarters of 2020, a recovery of sorts in the third and fourth quarters, and most likely a new recession right now. And so how long can the stock market levitate when that's the state of the world? And you mentioned jobs recovery. The unemployment rate has come down. I mean, you're right about that. But there's no jobs recovery. Initial claims are still high. They may come down week to week, but they're still 3 to 4 times what they are, what they were pre-pandemic. That the unemployment rate has come down, which it has, completely ignores labor force participation, which in my view is a much more important statistic. So what's the difference? So if you lost your job, but you don't go and you apply for unemployment benefits, but you're not looking for a job, well, why wouldn't you do that? Well, if you're a bartender and every bar in town is shut down, what are you going to do? I mean, you're really going to go down to the unemployment office every day and look for bartender jobs, and so forth. And so there is a huge element, and I'm talking 10 to 15 million Americans between the ages of 25 and 54, able-bodied, right, who are just not in the workforce. They don't have jobs, but they're not counted as unemployed because they're not, looking for jobs right now. And there are always some people who are not in the labor force for good reason. If you're a homemaker, if you're a student, if you're, above a certain age, and maybe you're just, put your feet up and you're retired, or disabled in some way. And yes, people with disabilities are a big part of the labor force, but sometimes that's an impediment. But the lesser reasons why you're not in the labor force. So that number never gets to be 100%. In fact, 70% is sky high. But what's happened in recent years is that has fallen from 70% to closer to 60%. Well, that's 10% of the labor force that's not in the labor force, not counted as unemployed. If you add those to the unemployment, then the unemployment rate is closer to 15%, not about 8%, which they're reporting. So you have to look behind these numbers. Again, don't judge by the unemployment rate and the S&P 500. Judge by the labor force participation, which includes tens of millions of people who can't get jobs, and the economy as a whole, where 50% of GDP is 45% of GDP and 50% of jobs are locked down. I don't care how Apple stock is doing. The economy is not doing well.
So as you say in the subtitle, there are certainly going to be winners and losers in this post-pandemic world. You believe that we are perhaps beginning another recession and in the midst of a new Great Depression. As you just pointed out, the labor force participation rate has fallen steeply. It shows that many people are not being counted in the official unemployment figures. If you add those in, unemployment rate is much higher. And you even discuss how job losses this time around were greater than all of the last four recessions combined. So correct. It's massive. And this is going to have permanent changes. It's not something that's temporary, unlike what we see with recessions. Tying this all together, how do you invest in a post-pandemic world?
Well, I make the point, and by the way, that the last comment points to the difference between a recession and a depression. Recessions are technically quantitatively defined. So conventionally, it's two or more consecutive quarters of declining GDP. There are a few other bells and whistles, but that's basically it. It's determined by something called the National Bureau of Economic Research, a bunch of academic economists based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a private group, but they're in and out of public office, but they're basically leading economists. So they're like the umpire in a baseball game. They call the balls and strikes. They said a recession began in February 2020. I agree with that. I reached the same conclusion. They haven't declared that it's over, but I expect that at some point they'll come out and say, yeah, it was over around July 2020. Because I mean, how can you have 33% growth in the third quarter of 2020, 33% annualized, and say you're in a recession? Probably not. So that first recession is over. I think we're in a second recession now, but the whole thing is a depression. And you can have growth in a depression. People say, well, if recession is two quarters of declining GDP and depression is worse, that must be 10 quarters of declining GDP. It must be a really long recession. That's not the definition. A depression means depressed growth relative to trend. As you can have growth in a depression, take the first Great Depression, 1929 to 1940. Well, there were two technical recessions in the Great Depression, 1929 to 1933. In 1937 and 1938. But between 1933 and 1936, the economy grew, unemployment came down. There were great years for the stock market, but you were still in a depression because you hadn't recovered any of what you had lost. You know, the stock market crashed in October 1929 and it dropped 89.2%, almost 90%. That's what a real stock market crash looks like by 1932. But if you ask people, well, when did it recover the old high? Like, when did we get back to the 1929 high? The answer is 1954. It took 25 years to get back to the old level. Now, it doesn't mean you couldn't make money in the meantime. You could. If you bought at the low in 1932 and you wrote it back, you know, good for you. But that's how long a real depression lasts. You can have growth, you can have declining unemployment, but the fact is you haven't recovered the lost ground and you're vulnerable to more recessions. I would say Japan's been in a recession since 1990, and the U.S. is in one now. Now, that doesn't mean there's nothing to do. It doesn't mean you have to curl up in a ball. And I point to a guy named Hugo Stinnes. I think most listeners are familiar with the Weimar Republic hyperinflation in Germany in the early 1920s. That story has been told quite often. But there was an individual, Hugo Stinnes, who saw it coming. He borrowed massive amounts of money in Reichsmarks. That was the currency of the time. He went out and bought hard assets. He bought coal, steel, transportation assets, vessels, railroads, etc. And then the hyperinflation came. He paid back all his debt in basically worthless money. I would say pennies on the dollar, but we're talking about a thousandth of a penny on the dollar. Basically, his debt went to zero because the currency was worthless, but he did pay it back and he kept the assets. And he became the richest man in Germany. And his nickname, I don't speak German, so I'll bungle my way through this, but his nickname was the Inflationskönig, which means the inflation king. Joseph P. Kennedy is another one who ramped stocks with, you know, Big Mike Mann and a gang of stock manipulators in the 20s, you know, bid them up, got the suckers to come in and then dumped them. And but by 1929, he could see the crash coming and he shorted the stocks and made another fortune in the early 30s. He was one of the richest men in America. So the point is, even in disastrous circumstances, the greatest hyperinflation of any industrial economy in history, and one of the greatest stock market crashes of any major economy in history, some people made fortunes. So there are things to do. And I talk about them in chapter 6 of the book. You know, right now, where are the opportunities? I would say gold, hard assets, 10-year treasury notes, residential real estate in certain locations, not everywhere, but certain locations. I would keep away from commercial real estate that has not hit bottom. You can look at it all you want, but I wouldn't touch commercial real estate until late 2021, at the earliest, maybe 2022. And equities, you got to be really selective. It's a little bubbly, but there's a place for equities. And I also recommend a large allocation of cash, maybe as much as 30%. And people say, well, wait a second, Jim, cash has no yield. And I say, that's right. But if we're going to have deflation, which I expect, deflation is a greater danger than inflation. I don't care what the Austrians and the monetarists and the Milton Friedman groupies and the neo-Keynesians say. Printing money does not cause inflation. What causes inflation is the velocity of money, the turnover. You print all the money you want, but $7 trillion times zero is zero. Is if you don't have velocity, you don't have an economy. Velocity is psychological, behavioral. The Fed does not know how to stimulate it. I do, and others do, and I talk about it in the conclusion of the book. But if you have deflation, cash can be your best performing asset because you have $1 million in the bank or $100,000 in the bank, and there's 2% deflation. The real value of your money went up 2% because your purchasing power went up 2%. But more importantly, cash has enormous embedded optionality. You can think of cash as an at-the-money call option on every asset class in the world. So right now there's a lot of uncertainty. Everyone knows that. So if you invest, you say, well, I'm going to invest in this or that, and you decide 6 months from now you were wrong because it looks like things are heading another way, it's not easy to get out. I mean, try getting your money back from Henry Kravis. Good guy, but he's not going to give you your money back. Or you have to cross the bid offer, or you got commissions or other high costs, or you can't get out at all. So I'm not saying don't have any risky assets. You have to have some, but cash will give you the ability to lay back. It reduces the volatility of your portfolio, performs well in deflation, but above all, it gives you optionality. So when we have greater visibility, then yes, you can be the person to pivot into something more specific once we know more.
The title of the book, once again, is The New Great Depression, Winners and Losers in a Post-Pandemic World. And we've been speaking with its author, Jim Rickards. And the book, I want to point out, is set to be released January 12th. And already, even though it hasn't been released yet, it's listed as the number one bestseller on Amazon. I don't know how that works, Jim, but you've written an excellent book. And I want to highly recommend it to everyone in our audience.
Thank you very much.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.